Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. I am in dialogue today with Dr. James Deem. James was Associate Professor of Communication Skills at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He is a published author of children's books and has published children's books since 1988. He has published 26 books. We are here today to discuss his new book, The Prisoners of Breen Donk, Personal Histories from a World War II Concentration Camp, published in New York by Houghton Mifflin, 2015. James, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you, Ari. It's nice to be here with you.
To begin, kindly tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the scholarship you would engage in as an adult?
Well, I was born and raised in Wheeling, West Virginia. My father worked for the railroad as a dispatcher, the B&O Railroad, and my mother was a housewife. I'm the oldest of four children, born in 1950. I had a very normal childhood up until the age of about 10. I played outside a lot. I was interested in war games. I had plastic soldiers that I would set up in the backyard and have mock battles. But then around the time that I was 10, my mother, unbeknownst to basically her children and other members of the family, was diagnosed with probably inoperable colon cancer. And so she made some decisions at that point that had a profound effect on my life. About 10 months before she died, I was 10 years old, she said, "I'm going to take you to the movies." My mother had never taken me to the movies before by herself. And she had had one operation to kind of alleviate some of the problems with the cancer. I did not know she had cancer. And she said, "We're going downtown on the bus." So we went downtown. She didn't tell me what we were going to see. We walked into the theater and it was The Diary of Anne Frank, the original movie, with Millie Perkins. And I had no concept of anything about World War II, except that it was soldiers fighting. So I knew nothing of the Holocaust. And I sat there in the theater, completely unprepared, and was overwhelmed with new information, which also scared me greatly. And I had a very active imagination. So when I went home that day and for a long time after that, I could imagine SS troops marching through my neighborhood. I developed a plan for how I would hide in my attic with the bookcase in front of the door to the attic so that I couldn't be found. And so that was really an important event in my young life. But equally important was the fact that after my mother died, about 10 months later, so I was still about 10 years old, my father remarried and we were going to move to Arizona from West Virginia. And so he cleaned out the house and he put a lot of possessions out on the curb for the garbage trucks to take. And fortunately, my grandmother, my mother's mother, was watching from a distance. She wasn't in communication with my father. And she was able to rescue some of the things that he left on the curb after we drove away that night. And one of the things that he rescued was my baby book, which I had never seen. And my grandmother gave it to me. And in the baby book, it said, it had birthday cards for my first birthday and other things and how much I weighed. But it also had a newspaper article that my mother had clipped and glued in. And it said, "What happened on this date in history?" And I was born on January 27th, 1950. January 27th is, in 1950, is the fifth anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And it was noted in this newspaper article. Now, when I saw the baby book, I'm not sure it had a profound effect on me at that particular moment because I was still very young. But as I grew up, I realized, oh, the Diary of Anne Frank, 5 years to the day that Auschwitz was liberated, it ended up meaning something to me. And so that's kind of, a long-winded version of telling you how I became interested in things related to World War II and the Holocaust specifically.
What inspired you to write this particular book? What message do you hope to convey to readers?
Well, in 2010, my wife and her sister and I and a couple of friends were spending a week in Belgium. And it rains a lot in Belgium. And so one rainy day, we needed something to do indoors. And we found information about a concentration camp, Brandonk. And I had, at that point, already written two books for teenagers, one on Kristallnacht and one on Auschwitz. So I was very familiar. And I had also visited many, many concentration camps in Germany, Poland, and Austria. And I had never heard of Brandonk before. And we all agreed this might be an interesting trip. So we drove there that morning and walked into the camp, and I was just blown away. It was one of, it was like walking into a nightmare, because it's one of the best preserved camps, SS camps, still in existence in Europe. And I had the audio guide that I was listening to, but because I'm an author, I wanted to know more. And I'm always looking for another subject to write about. And so I went into the gift shop afterwards, and I said, "Oh, do you have any books about Brandonk in English?" No, they did not. And so when they told me they didn't, I thought, maybe this is a book that I would like to write. And so that was my inspiration. It's like nothing available in English. And I thought, maybe it's time for there to be a book in English.
What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
Well, I would like them to become familiar with Brandonk. I would like them to understand that it is kind of an ignored camp that the SS established, but it's equally as important as all the others, because even though it was a small camp, the people who were murdered there were just as important as anyone murdered at any of the larger camps anywhere else. And it's important to remember them and also to honor them and their place in history.
Can you narrate the history and chronology of the Breendonk camp for us? When was it created? Why? Where is it located? How did its role evolve and change?
Well, Breendonk is one of a number of forts that were built in the early 1900s to encircle Antwerp. So there are two rings of forts, and Breendonk is a fort in the outer ring. It was built, I think it was started in 1909, and it was completed in 1914, just a short time before World War I began. The ring of forts was constructed to protect Antwerp from invasion from the Germans. And at the time that it was built, it was the most advanced kind of fort. But the problem is that the Germans had weapons that no one could foresee that made the fort kind of it wasn't going to be a useful fort anymore. So it was attacked at the beginning of World War I and bombarded by the Germans. After World War I, it was basically used as a facility for storage by the Belgian army. And then at the beginning of World War II, because Breendonk is located in an ideal position on the main road between Brussels and Antwerp, halfway between, it became kind of like the Belgian military command headquarters at the beginning of World War II. And it was also attacked and capitulated to the Germans after a very short time in May 1940. And within a few months, the Germans took over the fort and turned it into a prison camp that they called an Aufanglager, kind of like a reception camp. And this was going to be a camp where political prisoners were going to, and other prisoners, even just criminal prisoners, were going to be held until they were either released or transported to other camps in the Nazi system. And I would add that perhaps one of the reasons why Breendonk is so overlooked is that altogether, during the war, there were only 3,600 prisoners or so. So it was a very, very small camp. And because it wasn't an official concentration camp, just an Aufanglager, it's kind of overlooked for that reason. But about half of the prisoners did die. I prefer to say were murdered. It doesn't matter whether they were starved, committed suicide, were transported somewhere else and died of starvation there or exhaustion or whatever. They were murdered because of the system that the SS established. So about half of the 3,600 prisoners ended up dead, but only 303 prisoners were murdered in the camp itself, and another 54 were executed elsewhere. They were prisoners in Breendonk, and they were transported other places and executed in Belgium. So it very small numbers, but that doesn't matter at all. The number of people who were prisoners there and who died there or in other camps is irrelevant.
What kind of camp was Breen Donk? How does Breen Donk exemplify or challenge the terms and terminologies that are used to characterize different camps, such as internment camp, concentration camp, transit camp, prison camp? Was Breen Donk indeed a concentration camp in the genuine sense of a concentration camp, or does it challenge the definition of a concentration camp?
Well, it was not an extermination camp. It was not a death camp in the sense of there was no gas chamber or anything like that, even though when it was liberated by the Allies in 1944, there was an article written about the gas chamber there, but there was no gas chamber. It really was a holding camp. It was a prison camp, and it did end up being a transit camp because many of the prisoners were transported to other camps in the SS system. Some went to another small camp in the Netherlands called Vught, and others were taken to Buchenwald, to Mauthausen in Austria, Sachsenhausen. They were deposited many places, and some prisoners were actually released and free to leave. Some only to be rearrested again and brought back to Breen Donk.
How many individuals were detained there? Where did they come from? Where were they deported to subsequently?
Well, there were 3,600 prisoners, give or take a few. Because the records were lost or destroyed, it's impossible to know exactly how many, but for more or less, you could say about 3,600 prisoners. There may be a few hundred others who were there for a short time, but were never registered at the camp. So I would say it's safe to say that there were under 4,000 prisoners total. There were never more than 660 prisoners there at a time. So, and often there were many fewer prisoners there at a time. The first year, I would say, was the most difficult in some sense, because that's when most of the prisoners were Jews. The largest number of Jews initially were prisoners during the first few months, and mostly arrested because they were Jewish and interned there. As the camp progressed, there were Russian prisoners brought in. There were political prisoners brought in. There were resistance members brought in. So there was a whole assortment of different people who were brought into the camp. Eventually, some would be sent to other camps, Buchenwald especially. Mauthausen Neuengamme, those were three major ones where prisoners were sent. And many of the Jewish prisoners ended up being sent to the official transit camp in Belgium, which is called Dossenkazerne. And Dossenkazerne is in a town called Mechelen. And it was established, I believe, in 1942, the camp there. It was an old army barracks, and many of the Jewish prisoners who were going to be transported to Auschwitz were sent to Dossenkazerne and then placed on a series of convoys to Auschwitz, where many were murdered upon arrival.
Why is Breen Donk considered an ignored camp? Why is less attention devoted to Breen Donk than to other camps Jews were sent to during the Holocaust?
Well, because it had a very low number of Jewish prisoners, like let's say out of 3,600 prisoners, maybe 600 were Jewish, and it's not definite exactly how many Jews were interned there, because I would say a high proportion of the Jews who were sent to Brendonk were immigrants to Belgium who did not have proper paperwork. They were running away from horrible situations in Germany or in Austria after Kristallnacht. So they didn't go through the proper procedures to have the proper paperwork to be in Belgium. So if you were a Jew and an official Belgian resident, you were not, you never registered your religion. So there is no, you know, you didn't have to identify your religious beliefs on any kind of registration document for citizenship in Belgium. So it's not necessarily, you know, so if you look through the records of who the prisoners were, it doesn't identify them by religion at all. So it's only if the SS got involved and identified them in that way that that it became clear who was Jewish and who was not. And there are certain other documents that reveal this information, but perhaps no more than 600 were Jews out of the 3,600. So it's a smaller proportion than at other camps where the overwhelming majority of the people in the camp were Jewish.
What kinds of atrocities were perpetrated in Brendonk? What were the similarities or differences between atrocities committed in Brendonk vis-a-vis other concentration camps?
Well, I would say it was very similar. The situation was overwhelming in terms of the brutality showed to the prisoners. Just the daily schedule alone, prisoners were up early, especially during the first year or so, where there were very few toilets on site. There was no running water on site, or very little running water on site. And the guards would beat prisoners. Prisoners would be starved. The Brendonk is surrounded by a moat, so that makes it very unusual. And so anyone who would try to escape would have to find a way to get across the moat, which was not very feasible. Some people would be brutalized by guards in the moat. Some prisoners committed suicide in the moat. The working conditions, almost all prisoners were forced to work on the site. Because it was an old fort built to a certain specification, it was covered in sand so that it would seem invisible to an invading army. So when the SS took over Brendonk, the main work that was involved there for the prisoners was the removal of sand from the fort. And so there were special kind of like iron carts that the prisoners had to fill with rocks and sand and move them on rails to the other side of the moat and dump them. They had to, it was backbreaking work, and it didn't matter what the weather was, no matter how hot or how cold or whether it was snowing or raining, they had to work in that, and even if they were sick. So it was, they were brutalized in all senses of the word, starved and in every possible way. They were given very little to eat, especially, you know, it was just a few ounces of bread a day, some watery soup at lunchtime. And instead of coffee, they were given acorn coffee. It was just acorns stewed in hot water, and they would get two cups of that in the morning and two cups of that in the evening. So there were many cases of starvation at the camp because of the brutality of what the prisoners were given to eat. So I would say it was very similar. There was also a torture chamber where especially political prisoners or members of the resistance were taken into the torture chamber, and they might be initially offered something. Oh, if you'd like something to eat, if you just tell us your information, they would, be tempted perhaps to reveal sources or contacts. Most chose not to, and so they might be burned with cigarettes. They would be handcuffed with their hands behind their back, and the handcuff would be attached to a pulley, which would then raise their arms behind their back so that their shoulders would be dislocated. They might be burned by an iron poker. The brutality was just terrifying. And because it was a concrete fort, basically a long kind of H-shaped tunnel system more than anything else, if a prisoner was in the torture room and was screaming, the screams reverberated throughout the tunnels all the way into all of the prisoner rooms so that everyone could hear it. So that it was emotional torture as well.
Can you say more about the forms of food that were consumed in Breentonk? What forms of malnutrition were experienced?
Well, for breakfast, they were given, the prisoners were given 2 cups of acorn coffee and 3.5 ounces of bread, which if you think of what a regular grocery store loaf of bread, sliced bread is like today, that's about 2.5 slices of bread. That was breakfast. So 2.5 slices of bread and 2 cups of really disgustingly bitter acorn coffee. Lunch, 2 bowls of watery soup. Maybe there would be a few scraps of a vegetable in there, or a tiny scrap of a piece of meat if you were very lucky. And at dinner, it would be 4 ounces of bread, so maybe the equivalent of 3 pieces of modern day bread and 2 more cups of acorn coffee. So basically, you were getting very few calories considering that you were working at hard labor for 8 hours a day. So it didn't take much for prisoners to lose a lot of weight in a very short amount of time. Some had to be hospitalized in a military hospital in Antwerp because they were close to death from starvation. Now, if a prisoner was very clever, and some were, at lunch, they would be starving, of course, by then. But if they were clever, they would hold off from getting their soup, or if they were allowed 2 bowls, at least the second bowl, if they were one of the last people to get a second bowl of soup, that meant that maybe some of the better stuff was at the bottom of the big pot of soup, and they would get a little more sustenance that way. Occasionally there might be a teaspoon of jam that the prisoners got. And eventually, because so many prisoners were starving during the first, let's say, 9 months of Breentonk, changes were made so that a little more food was given to the prisoners, but this varied depending on, there was always a conflict between the military government in Belgium and the SS who ran the camp. And the SS would not take orders from the military government. They only took it from the SS command in Berlin. And so the SS was always more cruel and vicious towards the prisoners. And if they could deprive them of food, they would do it. Sometimes prisoners would get food packages from relatives. This was permitted at different points over the time that Breentonk was an SS camp. And of course, the SS guards would open the packages, and if they saw something that looked good, they would take it for themselves and eat it themselves. But prisoners were very... they liked, you know, they kind of tricked themselves into not feeling so terrible about the conditions they were living in. And what they would do is take their bread, cut it into tiny little pieces, and savor a tiny little piece at a time as if it was a huge chunk of bread. And some would even save their evening bread, some of their evening bread, so that they could have a little more in the morning. They did all kinds of things so that they could cope mentally with the starvation that they faced at the camp.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you discuss some of the surprising information about the camp that you discovered in your research?
Well, if you ever go to Brain Dong, one of the first things you'll see as you walk in, it's the old kitchen room, is you'll see a picture of one of the prisoners whose name is Israel Neumann. And Israel Neumann was a Jewish prisoner who was one of the very first prisoners. He was arrested very early October 1940. He was a very short man, and he was born in Poland, and he was badly mistreated and murdered at the camp. But you'll see a number of photographs of him as you tour the camp. And so he become, and there is a lot of information about him on the audio guide when I went through back in 2010. And I was really moved by his story and the horrible treatment that he received. And so one of the surprising things was, I thought, let me see what I can find out about him. And so I went on Ancestry.com, which, I can't even explain why I did that, but I found him. And he and his family had immigrated to the United States in 1921. And his family lived in New York City starting in 1921. But he left after a few years and went back to Europe. And so I was really surprised that no one had ever discovered this information. He could have stayed in the U.S. with his family for reasons that are, you know, you can't find in Ancestry.com why he ended up going back to Europe. He tried to go back to his family again, but he got waylaid at Ellis Island and was not permitted to go into the U.S. A second time. He was held in quarantine for, I think, 3 months before he was sent back to Europe and eventually found his way to Belgium. So, that was a surprising thing, to be able to find out more about him and his family. Another surprising thing was the amount of artwork that was done at Brain Dong by one of one of the prisoners, Jacques Ox, who was a professor of art in Liège, Belgium, and he was asked by the commandant of the camp, Philip Schmidt, to draw pictures. And Ox, who had Jewish heritage, was co-opted by Schmidt to draw anti-Semitic art of the Jewish prisoners. Schmidt wanted these drawings so that he could give them as gifts to his friends and colleagues. But Ox kind of surreptitiously also made a second copy of them and hid the copy away. He made other drawings that were not anti-Semitic at the camp, which kind of showed what the brutality was like. And these have all been collected in a book by Ox after the war. And it gives you a really clear idea of what life was like at the camp. And to me, that was particularly surprising. And the third really surprising thing about the camp was that a propaganda photographer was brought in by the SS in June 1941 to take photographs of non-Belgian prisoners, which primarily meant Jewish prisoners. And this propaganda photographer took, I think it was 37 photos, which were lost until 1986, when a Dutch photography collector found them in an auction, I think it was in Germany, and bought them and realized he didn't know exactly what he was buying, but he knew it was from the war. And he realized that these were 37 photos taken of Braindonk and the prisoners from June 1941. And of course, this is where the photos of Israel Neumann were made, and other prisoners as well. And it gives you a really clear idea of what life was like in the camp photographically, which is quite unusual, because at almost every other concentration camp, any photographs that were ever taken were done surreptitiously by guards, or maybe occasionally by a prisoner. But there are very few photographs taken during the time that a concentration camp was in operation. So these photos are quite surprising and unusual.
Can you tell us about some of the victims of Braindonk? Can you share any personal stories?
Well, it's, you know, the more I researched, you know, the more attached I became to many of the prisoners. And Israel Neumann was one of them, because I was able to find out so much about him and his family. I kept on working on Ancestry.com to find out more what happened to his family. And I eventually lost track of them, because you can't find information after 1950, because US doesn't release census records after 1950 for quite a while now. And so that was of interest to me. Perhaps one of the prisoners, well, one situation that I came across was, there was a Belgian man who was Catholic, Louis de Hauer, and he was arrested as a member of the resistance, and he ended up being executed at Braindonk. His wife was Jewish. She was an immigrant from the Netherlands with her family. Both Louis and his wife Charlotte worked in the Diamond District in Antwerp, and they were both communists and members of the resistance. The SS basically came well, the SIPO SD, that's kind of like the Gestapo in Belgium, came looking for Louis because they had heard that he was a member of the resistance. And when they couldn't find him because he had been tipped off, they arrested his wife, Charlotte, and put her in prison. She was pregnant at the time, and no one knows what ended up happening to the baby. She was eventually sent to Auschwitz, where she was murdered. And Louis was executed by firing squad at Braindonk, but they had a daughter before they were both arrested. And the daughter became a friend of mine and shared information about her life. And it was actually one of the most meaningful relationships that came out of doing the research for the book. One of the things that happened after I wrote the book and it was published was I was contacted by a woman whose grandfather was one of the capos at Braindonk. He was a Jewish capo. At Braindonk, they called him Zugführers. So he was a room leader, and he was one of the most vicious of all. And she contacted me because she didn't know. She had read the book, but she didn't know much about her grandfather. And she wondered also about her father, because her father was in Belgium at the same time that her grandfather was doing horrendous things at Braindonk. And she wondered if I had more information. And so I was able to give her more information about her father, who was not a good person either, but was not at Braindonk. Perhaps one of the most heartbreaking prisoners for me, besides Israel Neumann, was a German Jew, Jürgen Jakobsen, who was arrested. He was an electrician. He had moved. He was in Danzig, moved to Germany after Kristallnacht. He came to Belgium hoping, with his wife and his mother, trying to live a better life, a free life away from Nazism. He became an electrician. He had his own business, and he was he believed in the humanity of people. He wanted a common language for everyone. He was in an organization that was dedicated to having Esperanto become the common language of the world. But he was under suspicion by the Belgian government, the regular Belgian government. And so he was spied on when he went to the Esperanto meetings. And at any rate, as the war began, he was arrested and sent to Braindonk and was horribly mistreated and was released finally, after a short stay at the camp. But there is a before and after picture of what he looked like on his identity card before, and one that was a photograph that was taken shortly after he was released. And you could just see the terrible situation that he had lived through at the camp. And then eventually he was arrested again, along with his wife and his mother, and they were sent to Auschwitz and murdered there. So it's, for me, it was heartbreaking because his heart was in the right place. He wanted so much for world peace and harmony and good things, and this is what happened to him. And it's,
can you tell us about the perpetrators who ran the Braindonk camp? What became of them? Can you tell us about their fate?
Well, you have the commandant was Philip Schmidt. He was commandant for quite a while, and he was married to a woman who was from New Jersey, believe it or not, and they lived near the camp, and he had a German Shepherd dog that he would use to attack the prisoners with. He was a horrible person, and a very good Nazi. His secondhand man was Arthur Prowse. Arthur Prowse had more contact with the prisoners and was also perhaps the most cruel of the SS at the camp. Schmidt, after the war, was convicted of war crimes. He was the only Nazi who was executed in Belgium after the war. Prowse disappeared, and no one knows what happened to him. Probably killed in Germany sometime during the last few days of the war. The other perpetrators were often, well, some were Jewish prisoners who were promoted to be the room leaders, the Zugführers, and they were often particularly cruel to the prisoners in their rooms, and some of them were executed after the war. Some were imprisoned. There were Flemish SS members, because when the SS came into Belgium, they wanted to have other members, and so m many Flemish men who were out of work and looking for something better joined the SS and began to work at the camp, and they were equally as cruel. And some of them were imprisoned after the war. Some of them were executed as well after the war.
Which specific studies of concentration camps in academic literature by other historians and Holocaust scholars had the greatest influence on you in developing this work? Which academic works on Belgian history during World War II and the Holocaust impacted you most? Were there any previous pieces of research on Brinzong that you found helpful in the course of this study?
Well, there the main book about Brandong, as I began to do my research, was one called Brandong, and it was written by Patrick Nefors, Nefors. It was written in Dutch, and it's also translated into French. There is no English version of the book, and I would say it's kind of the main source of information about Brain Dunk. It's a very thorough book. There are other books about Belgium during World War II. There's one entitled Belgium and the Holocaust: Jews, Belgians, Germans, which was edited by Dan Michman, and I found that to be particularly helpful. The other books that were particularly useful to me were the diaries and memoirs, let's say, of some of the prisoners who were at the camp. Interestingly enough, there were many well-educated people who were prisoners there, newspaper editors, professors, lawyers, doctors, whatever. And some of them did write accounts of what happened to them at the camp. One of the most, let's see if I can find it here, is, is by a man named Jean Amery, Amery, who changed his name after the war. He was Hans Meyer, Mayer, but he did a little changing around of the letters of his last name. He didn't want to be associated with anything that sounded German after the war, and so he changed it to Amri. And he was tortured at the camp, and he wrote a book called At the Mind's Limits, Contemplations by a Survivor on Auschwitz and Its Realities. But in this book, he talks about what happened when he was tortured at Brain Dunk. And it's not a long section, but it's a very valuable book. And unfortunately, Jean Henri ended up committing suicide later in life. So the effects of torture can be long-lasting and devastating.
What challenges did you face in researching this book? What adversities and frustrations did you have to deal with? How did you work around them?
Well, of course, I knew the first day that I was there in September 2010 that I wanted to write the book. And so I began to figure out how I might go about doing that. And I found out that there was an archive of documents at the camp itself. But basically everything in the archive, of course, was either in Dutch, German, or French, almost nothing in English. And I have a minor in French in college, but I had no expertise or any knowledge of Dutch. And I did take 1 year of high school German, so I knew a little bit about German and how difficult it was. So as I began to do the research, eventually in the archives there, I had to rely on translation software so that I could translate documents and understand what they were saying. That was a challenge, but it was a good challenge because I was able to find things that seem to have escaped other people. One of the things that I tried to do was, in reading the memoirs that had been written by prisoners, I tried to piece them together into a coherent chronology of what exactly happened in the camp. And one of the challenges there was that because everything was done verbally at the camp, when a prisoner who was writing an account would be remembering something, he was relying on the speech that he heard, which would be maybe very different from what actually the name was. I mean, prisoners were called by their number. And so if a prisoner told another prisoner, "Oh, my name is so-and-so," they may not have understood the name. They may be spelling it wrong. There may be, you know, they may have changed their name slightly. So I tried to read as many of the accounts as I could and connect them, even if it meant reading into it slightly, like, "Oh, he's really talking about not Isaac, but Israel, Israel Neumann, but maybe for some reason in his memory, he's thinking that this person is Isaac." So the confusion between what was heard and what the real name was or the real event was interesting to try to put together. So the languages, the connection of speech to writing, those were all obstacles that I faced. And also trying to find, my book is filled with photographs and artwork that really give, I hope, a thorough picture of what life was like at the camp and at the other camps where prisoners were transported. And that took a lot of work to find those photographs and illustrations, and then get cooperation from those sources asking, would I be able to use these illustrations in my book? There was a lot of work that went into putting the whole book together.
What challenges did you face in getting this book published?
Well, I knew in 2010 that I wanted to write the book. It took until 2012 to get permission from my publisher that they would give me a contract to write the book. I couldn't write the book unless I had a contract, because I knew it was going to take a huge chunk of time, energy, and money to be able to research the book. So I did lay some groundwork for the book before the publisher finally agreed to let me write it. But I think the initial reaction from my publisher was, well, why would anybody want to read about this place in Belgium? You know, it's like, well, because I want to read about this place in Belgium, and I can't believe that someone else wouldn't want to read about it too. And since there's no book in English on it, I think it would make sense. The other thing that was kind of distressing to me about the book was, in the initial stages, the book is, the manuscript is finished and it goes out to a design house that designs the book and decides what the font is and what the headings will look like. And they sent back samples of what they had in mind for designing of the book. And so in every chapter, usually there is some kind of section break. So there should be some little iconography image that would show, well, that's where this section of text ends, and then we're going to begin another section. And so in the first draft of the design, all of the icons that indicate a text break or a section break, they were all Nazi SS symbols. And I just was speechless that they would do that to my book. I said, we cannot have Nazi iconography in this book like this. It cannot happen.
What is your book's contribution to Holocaust studies?
Well, when I wrote the book, I wasn't thinking that I was making any contribution to Holocaust studies. It was just a book that I wanted to write about Brain Donk and in English. I can see now that the book has been published that it does provide information about what happened to Jewish prisoners at Brain Donk, what happened when they were transported other places. Even if it's a small number of Jewish prisoners, it names them, as many as I could. It honors them. They are remembered, and that's important. I guess it became my way of speaking for them and sharing what happened to them so that they were and could be remembered. Now, what's interesting is that my wife and I made many friends in Belgium on my many trips there while I was working on the book. And we go back to Belgium every year, a number of months each year. We rent an apartment in Antwerp, the same apartment. It's just a few streets away from where Israel Neumann lived with his wife. When we go to the grocery store, we pass by the street where he lived. We take the tram. We get off at the central station where he was arrested. It's a very meaningful continuation of the book in my life. And it's just so I'm still living it, I guess I would say. So if it's a contribution, I'm still trying to contribute in a sense, just in how I live my life.
What are some directions for new and future research on Green Dog that you would encourage new students and scholars to pursue? What unanswered questions about Green Dog persist? What topics might you suggest to a newcomer in Holocaust studies, such as a term paper in a course on Holocaust history? What subject matter pertaining to Green Dog would you encourage a veteran in Holocaust studies to explore, such as a monograph?
Well, I you know, anyone who's interested in Holocaust studies and pursuing that at Green Dog, I mean, certainly there are perhaps 600 Jewish prisoners whose stories could be told or analyzed much more thoroughly than I did. There's a lot of information that I was not able to publish about them, just because there wasn't enough room in the book. And, you know, there are certainly family, you know, many of the Jewish families were wiped out, and there were no surviving relatives of these families. But there were other Jewish prisoners who did have surviving family members, and it might be interesting to follow up on them and find out more information. That's something that hasn't happened.
As we bring our dialogue to a close today, can you tell us about your current project? What are you working on now or next?
Well, in a few weeks, I'll be 73 years old. And so I would really like to tell you that I have another book in progress, but there are books that I want to write. I am working on fiction at this point, but one of the books I wanted to write, but am really feeling overwhelmed and kind of unable to, is something that came up while I was working on the Brain Dog book. And I think this is a good ending to our conversation. So my wife is Jewish. I am not. I'm an atheist. And my wife, for all practical purposes, is too. But she, as I was working on Brain Dog, she told me, and I we had known this for a while, that she had some relatives who left Europe and moved to the UK and the US. That's how her family immigrated to the US a few generations ago. And, but she had heard that she had had relatives in Paris, and she didn't know anything about them. So as I was doing research on Brain Dog, I was able to go to Paris and find out about her relatives. And so she had two relatives, a husband and wife, who were related to, I believe it was her grandfather's brother. And they lived in Paris. He was from Russia initially. He fought in the revolution and then moved to Paris to be free of that conflict. He was injured in the war. He was a used clothing salesman at the flea market. He had a stall there, and his wife was a furrier. She worked for a furrier company. After the Germans invaded France, they lived in the Marais. And when the Veldiv happened, the Velodrome Roundup. The men had kind of gotten notice, like, oh, this might be happening, and so maybe you don't want to be home this night. Well, the SS arrested women instead and sent them to the Velodrome, and there were thousands of women and children who were imprisoned in the Velodrome, the bicycle, indoor bicycle track. And so the wife, Edes Brandman, was sent on a transport to Auschwitz. She lived about a week there. I don't know if she was, if she died of starvation or if she was sent to the gas chamber. It's impossible to find out. Her husband was found about a month later, and he was sent on a transport to Auschwitz from Drancy with 600 children. I think it was the first group of children that was sent to Auschwitz, and they were all gassed upon arrival. So it was chilling, upsetting to find out that my wife's two relatives who lived in Paris at the time had been murdered in Auschwitz. Now, I wanted to write a book about them, but I realized that there wouldn't be much information. The interesting thing about them is that they lived on a street right around the corner from a restaurant where my it's one of our favorite restaurants in Paris. We've been to Paris many times, long before we knew about these relatives. Maybe it's 50 yards away. We were drawn to this location. It's kind of interesting how things like that happen. So I thought maybe I would write a book about the Jews who lived on this street. I think there were 40-some Jews who were arrested, and a few survived, most did not. They were arrested at different times throughout the war. And it's just a very small street in Paris. It's one block long. And I started to do research on it. I accumulated a lot of information, and I thought, I don't think I can write this book. If I was 20 years younger, I think I could do it, but I just feel too old to do it now. So if anyone listening to this would like to pursue this, I have some information I'd be happy to give them. It's, you know, these kind of projects become immensely meaningful in ways that are hard to explain. And, you know, I hope that the little bit that I have done can inspire someone to do their little bit too, so that we never forget and never repeat what has happened in the past.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you have shared. Thank you for the erudition that you communicated to us in this dialogue, and that is present and manifest in this remarkable and very important book.
Okay. Thank you, Ari. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
As we bring our dialogue to a close, I am your host on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, Ari Barblatt. Today, I have been in touch with James Deem. He is a retired college professor who was associate professor of communication skills at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He has been a published author of children's books since 1988. He has published 26 books. Today, we have been discussing his recent book, The Prisoners of Breen Donk, Personal Histories from a World War II Concentration Camp, published in New York by Houghton Mifflin, 2015. Thank you.